Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, September 23rd, 2006. We are weekly from 3 to 4 live on the Internet on LaRouchePub.com. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. I'm with the economics section of the EIR Executive Intelligence Review News Service. And today we are having five guests on the extremely urgent strategic topic of the threat to shut down the entire auto machine tool industrial base of the United States. We have three guest United Auto Workers leaders from three different states in the Great Lakes auto manufacturing belt. And we have two people here live in the studio who've been involved in doing everything to prevent this shutdown. And I'm going to introduce them all in just a moment. But first, let me situate the a few recent developments, because one of the reasons we're having this particular show today on the 23rd is Congress itself is going to recess probably within about 10 days. We're in the countdown, as everyone knows, in the United States to the elections in November for the midterm elections. At the same time, the countdown is going wild on unraveling of the financial system internationally. There have been new developments in the past week on big deal hedge funds, like one called Amaranth in the state headquartered in Connecticut. Many others losing billions, literally Amaranth, maybe $6 billion. Maybe it lost $3 billion in 2 weeks. But this is just a reflection of the fact that even an honest gambler or a dishonest gambler can't find any way to make money anymore, as the system has wound down so bad, not in housing, not in commodities, not in energy. But what's going to happen next is the issue. And on that point, which we've seen in the Congress now still meeting in Washington, that there has been no action on such fundamentals as the industrial existence of the United States, while over the last 2 years, last 18 months especially, we've seen month by month the announcements of plant shutdowns, thousands of workers' jobs to be eliminated, in other words, globalization with a vengeance. And we'll remember that it was about almost exactly 18 months ago when General Motors appeared in some of the international headlines as maybe being shaky, that LaRouche blew the whistle and said, this is something that requires federal intervention. It's not just one corporation in trouble. It's the whole capacity of the United States to be able to be a modern producing nation. But as I said at the beginning, Congress hasn't acted on this, and I won't summarize here, but our guests will have things to say about the organizing, the initiatives of Mr. LaRouche, in fact, to put draft legislation out for the way how Congress should proceed. But we will hear a status report on that. The two things I want to stress, though, before I introduce our guests, they're the kind of things you need to know when you want your marching orders on who to blame and who to go after. I hope we all generally are in agreement that the fulcrum that would tilt things in a whole different way in the United States and therefore benefit the entire world and the history of mankind would be to get out these people in the White House, get out Dick Cheney and get out George Bush, George W. Impeach them. There's plenty of grounds. And I recommend you look on the LaRouche Political Action Committee website for a mass circulation call for that purpose. But one thing I want to really point out here about what's been stopping just the most basic kind of concern and initiative by Congress on the auto sector crisis is, in effect, I'm going to use a phrase, there's a secret government within our government of evil types that it's not just like a few or something. They involve figures connected to banking syndicates that have been operating for decades who don't want nation states anyway. And the Executive Intelligence Review is getting ready for press today. In fact, we're going to hold the presses in order to make it ready. An a blockbuster feature called The Secret Government Within the Government, and we are going to dish the dirt on the particular figure, John Train. It's going to have his whole genealogy. It's going to, that is, that goes back to the Train family, I think from the 17th century, 18th century, 19th, who were against the American Revolution, who ran opium on the clipper ships in China and forced it from India to China. So today's John Train, he's in his 80s, and he has been involved for over 20 years in explicitly a Get LaRouche task force. That's not our topic today, but that's the topic of this EIR special feature. And next week, that would be Saturday, September 30th, the LaRouche Show will have some of the team members, the authors of this expose of the Get LaRouche Task Force, because lo and behold, we've just noticed today, in fact, this morning, that in looking at what all this Mr. John Train has been up to in recent months, is that he wrote an a special column in April 1st this year, and I'm just going to read a few sentences from it. Remember, he's a New York City-based or a New England-based banker, has several investment funds in New York, and his column concerns destroying the auto sector of the United States. I do not exaggerate. The column from April 1st, 2006 by Mr. John Train is called Investing Like Mr. Morgan, Not Like Mr. Ford. And John Train says in the course of this that he's proud that his granddaddy, Mr. Train, worked with old J.P. Morgan and they did things right. They didn't dither around. They made brisk decisions when they had to hive off whole divisions of factories and get rid of surplus workers, excess workers. And they knew how to run companies. They didn't shilly-shally like the people who've run Ford and other companies. And so, in April, John Train writes, Ford and GM just announced major cutbacks in their U.S. operations, which are hemorrhaging cash. Also, they say they will reverse their traditional policy of producing what customers weren't buying, just to keep the plants running and the unions happy. Should not young Mr. Ford and his counterparts have had the courage and skill to perform the major amputations required to save the main body of their companies 10 years ago? That's the end of the quote. So, this is what Mr. John Train has said about the United Auto Workers, the workers of the thousands of workers across the United States. They should have been amputated 10 years ago, and good that they're being cut now. And so you see why LaRouche said in recent weeks, get the dirt out on John Train. Some of the other things that could be said about John Train, I can't say on the air. But I will now just identify one special date and time that everyone should know to help them focus on what they're doing in the upcoming days and weeks. The LaRouche Political Action Committee is going to have another international event people can participate in. It's October 31st, Halloween. Good day for this, to get rid of those who are trying to scare mankind. We're going to have a Berlin-Washington, D.C. Simultaneous event available on internet, and it's going to be Mr. LaRouche will speak at one of those locations, Berlin, I believe. It'll be 10 a.m., therefore, Eastern Time in the United States, 4 p.m. in Berlin. And this is part of a continuing series now of international webcasts. And the timing of this is obviously to take place before the elections in the United States and to help lift us all out of any of the dismal politics as usual subversion of what we ought to be doing in this country, and start to address what we can do on an emergency basis now, and looking forward what should be going on over the upcoming decades, as our forefathers have done, or we wouldn't be here today. I mean, that was the view of Benjamin Franklin. That was the view of Abraham Lincoln. What can we do for posterity? So this is an international dialogue opportunity. It's October 31st. I'll repeat again before we leave this show. And you can watch for details of that on LaRouchePac.com, LaRouchePac.com. So with that, let me say who we have here today to talk among, because I'm really going to turn it over to them and we'll have a fast-paced hour, but you'll see why. I said the Great Lakes Auto Belt. We're glad to have with us from Western New York, Andy Christich. Hi.
How are you today?
Good. And Andy, you're near Lockport or Buffalo?
I worked in Lockport, lived in Buffalo.
Okay. And we switch over to Wisconsin from Green Bay area, and we have Dan Audie, right?
Yes. Thanks for having me on, Marcia.
I'm glad you're there. And people should know we're talking about UAW leaders here and also civic leaders in so many ways. Dan's just running for office to change the scene out there in Wisconsin. I want to say, too, that joining us whenever he can make it, as soon as he's off work, right from the heart of the world auto sector in Saginaw, Michigan, is going to be Michael. Oh, Michael Balls. Are you there, Michael?
I am here. Thanks
And
for having me.
that's terrific. And if unless our engineer says otherwise, then we'll all be on now for the next 50 minutes. And Michael there, too. Okay, good. Michael needs no. Besides the UAW, I know he's active in the NAACP, the whole political scene, and Saginaw, in that greater Saginaw area. And here in the studio, we have from the LaRouche Youth Movement, Bill Roberts. Welcome.
Hi, Marcia. Good to be on the show.
Okay, and Bill is based in Detroit, but he's also here in the LaRouche Youth Movement War Room, which is coordinating the biggest impact possible here in North America, and especially in Washington, D.C., and he's been all around the Auto Belt directly meeting people for several years. And finally, Paul Gallagher. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Marcia.
My colleague here, who I will tell everyone since day one, he can tell you about it, but it's going back and forth to Washington, meeting with people, beating on people, doing everything to get action on the federal intervention on this emergency situation. Now, the way we'll just kick off here, and we're already getting emails, I'll turn to them in the course of the show, is that we'll ask Paul to just start off with some overview on the status and the dimensions of where we stand. You can review anything over the past, over the relevant over the fight. And then we're going to turn to Andy in Western New York to bring out some points, and otherwise continue with reports from Michigan and Bill Roberts here and also Wisconsin. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I think the one thing that I want to say respecting the effort in Congress, which is where this has all been focused for a year and a half, since we have discussed this problem on the show before, is that this is not the collapse of the auto industry that we are discussing with the Congress or that we're witnessing. It's the collapse of the industrial economy of the United States. People talk about it as an auto industry crisis or an auto industry collapse, and they talk about, we sometimes talk about saving auto, but that's presenting it falsely. It's a general economic industrial collapse in the country within which the auto industry and the auto, broadly the auto sector, is the biggest prize for the economy that needs to be saved and used and developed further, but it's by no means the only part of the economy that's in this collapse. Now, for a year and a half, Congress has been looking at the auto sector, and they have been declining to act, refusing to act to save the auto industry when they believed it was a special problem within auto. This is reprehensible, especially on the part of the president, who refuses to even talk to anybody in the auto industry, union, executive, or anything else, probably because he doesn't want to deal with any. He's an idiot, and he can't handle a complex problem like that, so he just doesn't want to discuss it. But even the Democrats in the Congress have had the opportunity over and over again in discussions with us and have declined. They have refused to act to save the auto industry as such, as crucial as it is, as a capacity. They've said that they couldn't do it because they were in the opposition, they didn't control the Congress. They've said they couldn't do it because the problem was too big. and they have simply stepped back from it. What is changing now, and even within this poor showing, it is changing the situation in Congress relative to our legislation, is that they are beginning to realize behind all the constant noise over the war and terrorism that the economy as a whole is going. The housing sector, the housing bubble is imploding. Mainly as a result of that, many other things are going down. Commodity markets are going down. As you mentioned, hedge funds, even the biggest of them, are finding that nowadays it's difficult even to make money by cheating. And so a lot of them are losing a lot of money. You've had reports to come out of regional Federal Reserve banks and so forth indicating just how fast economic activity, job creation, and incomes are falling. Now, in this, and remember, Linda LaRouche said in March that September, October were the months in which this real crash of the economy were going to occur. So in that situation, it is no longer the auto industry that we are demanding that they save, but rather the collapsing U.S. economy that we are telling them they've got to act on, and that they've got to act on it through the auto industry, which is the most capable and versatile tool that they have to stop this ongoing collapse. Given that situation, things are changing, and the time for maximum pressure on them is absolutely now, because we're approaching the election, we're approaching the time in which a great number of things could change quite suddenly, in which the attitude towards the legislation that we wrote is changing. You still have the, where I'm too small, I'm out of power, the Republicans control everything, and so on and so forth. But this interest is also among Republicans. So the opportunity is definitely there now for the retooling legislation that LaRouche has put forward, and we've got to redouble our efforts. We had a funny report today here in Loudoun County where we're broadcasting. It's supposed to be the county with the highest median income in the country.
$98,000, everyone.
$98,000 median income, annual income for a household. And 12% of the county, of the households in the county, visited and relied on the food bank for free food aid, much to their embarrassment in many cases, during the last year that ended June 30th. Here in the, that's 35,000 people, nearly 10,000 families in the supposedly wealthiest county in the country had to go to the breadline. So there's the condition into which these bubbles have brought this economy, and that's the situation in which congressmen are going to be forced, and congresswomen are going to be forced to act on this, because they're going to be run out of town on a rail if they won't do anything about jobs and won't do anything about reversing this. The auto industry is their means to do it.
Right. Well, let's go ahead and have people pitch in as they will. I'm saying from Western New York. Andy?
Yes, I'm here. One of the first things that I'd like to say is I agree with Paul 100%. It's not just an auto industry issue. It's kind of about a whole system of government and politics that allows, it's basically corporate greed. And it's not only allowing it, it almost seems to be encouraging it. We seem to be making a big deal out of federal intervention. There's so much resistance to it here for whatever reason, yet if you go to China or most Asian nations, not only their auto industries, but almost every other industry is subsidized by the government. And what is that but federal intervention of their own? It just seems like we're not on a level playing field.
Right. And Dan, you're in Wisconsin.
Yes, we have a lot of politics going on here. We have a chance to gain an open seat, so we have a lot of attention going on here. My biggest fear is that when there is a change in Congress, that we end up, as Democrats, doing the same as the Republicans. It's interesting to me, as I learn, both as a candidate and as a member and someone active in politics, how they actually believe in this service economy, which for those of us that go to work in a factory and are in manufacturing just does not make sense. And when we were at one of the lobbying webcasts while we were out in Washington, we talked to a Douglas Christopher Ray, who's a legislative assistant to Mr. Sensenbrenner, and I had to ask him, explain to me how the service economy works, because it just seems to be a myth. And he basically said, well, there's financial investors and advisors, and then there's people that deliver pizza. And I was shocked that he actually said it and that he meant it. For anyone, this should be very alarming that not only have we witnessed manufacturing going under, the good-paying jobs leaving, are affecting all areas of the economy, and that should be more than a red flag.
And that's not unlike what was said by Mr. Miller, the CEO of Delphi, where we I believe what he said is we have educated people and lawn cutters, and we were referred to as the lawn cutters of society. And for what it's worth, my position at Delphi, I'm no longer there, and I'm no longer a union officer. I had to give up that position. I've taken $4 an hour cut in pay. I'm no longer a skilled tradesman, and I've transferred to another plant, which is my third plant since I started working for GM. I'm 2.5 years away from reaching eligibility for pension, and I made this shift hopefully to lock in a pension, which is kind of one of the things that we all looked forward to and worked towards. But at Delphi, it didn't look too secure, so I gave up quite a bit again just to maintain that, and we'll see where this goes. I am on my third plant at this point.
That's something I'd like to, sorry to hear that too, Andy, that in our circles, it never seems to affect us until it does, and then it's too late. But I'd encourage anybody that had to take a different job or a cut in pay to try to provide for their family to get involved and put the pressure on Congress. It truly is up to the people to force them to do their job and legislate and look out for the general welfare of all of the people.
I'm right there with you, Dan. I kind of, in the years past, always thought, well, someone will do this, someone will do it, and obviously someone isn't, so it's up to people like you and I and the rest of us that are on this call today.
Absolutely.
And one of these things, I went to an orientation at this new GM plant, and they pushed that we all need to be ambassadors for General Motors and help sell their cars, and no one can sell them better than the workers. And my thought is that as union employees, union people, what we really need to be selling is ourselves, and we need to be selling the unions and the idea of what unions do for a nation. People, I have a neighbor who's a teacher who commented on you guys making this kind of money, and I just kind of tossed back at him, I think you have a pretty good living yourself, and you're a non-union school teacher, yet you're surrounded by union school districts. Why do you think you get the wage that you do? If those union school districts weren't there, you wouldn't make this wage. And if the non-union didn't pay you the wage you're paying, you would certainly jump ship. You're there because they pay the same wage that the union set. And people don't seem to realize that as unions drop and as these pay scales drop, so will the other non-union positions with them.
Well, even on the tax base, especially for a public servant, you know, somehow making a decent wage and an honest living has somehow become a bad thing. And earning good wages pays good taxes to support all the other infrastructure things that we need to exist in this country.
Well, it appears that someone up at the top of the pile would rather have us, if you've got a roof over your head and food in your stomach, what are you complaining about? Don't worry about a fancy car or a vacation or any other luxuries. You're warm and dry and you've got food. I think that's all you need. And it seems that they're getting us to that point where they expect us to be happy with subsistence, basic minimum subsistence living, and I guess people, it's not human nature. We all strive for more.
That sounds more like an American nightmare than the American dream.
Right.
I think we should remember that it's not the auto industry. It's not even the unions. This is in other words, we are not arguing for the auto industry. We're not even organizing for the or arguing for the union movement. We're arguing for saving the country. We're all involved, and despite the changes that people go through, in a certain way, you have to raise your level mentally if you get knocked down in some way substantially at work or otherwise. You have to raise a level mentally to what we're all trying to do. We're all trying to impeach Bush and Cheney before they start a war in October, before they either attack Iran directly through Israel or by some other means start another war in order to prevail in this election. We're out to impeach them. We're all out to name the names of the deindustrializers in the country who don't come from the industrial sector. They come out of the banking sector into industry, and they wreck it.
Like he mentioned Steve Miller, huh?
Steve Miller, but Felix Rohatyn started this when he took over Chrysler Corporation temporarily in 79 and 80, and that was the first company that shrunk in the auto industry, and he shrank it. And Rohatyn, it is essential to name his name, just like John Train's name, and the banks they represent so that people understand who it is that's really doing this. That's part of the fight also. And that's where we have gotten under the skin of the Congress, to the point where individual congressmen, and Bill knows this from the limb organizing, individual congressmen have jumped up and down and yelled at us, Rohatyn, Rohatyn, why are you talking about Rohatyn? Why are you always talking? Get away from me with this stuff. That's when you know that you've gotten under their skin, just like Bill Clinton knew that he had wiped the floor with Chris Wallace in this interview that you're going to see tomorrow. Because you have to be tough in that regard and name the top names because they're the ones that we're out to defeat.
I think
we're getting closer to doing that.
One thing let me ask here, is Michael still on in Saginaw, right?
Still on.
Yeah, because I don't want to cut you off if that was Dan. But Michael, from Michigan there, of course, you're the leading auto state. We're just talking about this as a fight for the continuation of our nation or not. But on this issue of what Congress will or won't do, I mean, I know I presume you've had a lot of interaction, right, with the public at large and your congressional delegation. You want to throw anything in here?
I work for Delphi Corporation. Used to be Saginaw Steel and Gear, prior to General Motors. And I thought something was up when they split us off and said Delphi. And sure enough, you know, now we finna file bankruptcy. They finna retire everybody by January. They're bringing in workers for $14 an hour. They're gonna mess our economy up so bad that we got people coming in there making $14 an hour. And they're so happy to have those jobs, they don't know what to do with no benefits. But yet the same guys that split us off and do that, they got all the benefits in the world and making all the money that they want to make. I'm extremely not happy with this situation. I hope that our congressmen and state representatives can do something better, and the people in D.C. seem like they just don't care. You know, like the gentleman said before, he said all the other countries do subsidize their auto industry. The biggest industry they try to subsidize, they don't allow other people to bring their cars into their country. But then, yeah, we can't even sell our cars anywhere because of the situation that's going on right now.
Well, I can tell you, gentlemen, that you'll be happy to know that the LaRouche Youth Movement has been involved in giving the Congress a healthy ass-kicking over the last couple of months.
The uplifting experience, I believe.
Yeah, that's the term. But in what was brought up about this mentality coming from the Congress and coming from certain layers who are, it appears, appeasing their slave masters, the Felix Rohatyns and so forth, by sort of going along with the fascist policies and not addressing these things. I can let you know that over the course of the month of August, the LaRouche Youth Movement was deployed nationwide as the Congress, the congressional members, were back in their districts. And we really did intersect. We deployed ourselves into the town hall meetings, which were, there were dozens of these things being held, and spoke out at these sessions because we wanted to increase the pressure on the especially the Democratic caucus, the Democrats in the Congress. And we pushed the issue of it's time to impeach Cheney and Bush. Why are you not doing it? And we brought up the question of the need for the Economic Recovery Act, the need for nuclear energy to be built. And what happened, and through these town hall meetings and through our interventions, pamphlet distributions, as these congressmen were back in their district, was they got an enormous amount of pressure put on them. At these town hall meetings, other people started speaking up in certain cases, jumping right in, talking about how nuclear energy is safe, we need this, you know, why haven't they been acting? And there's an enormous amount of rage out there. And so when Congress came back in September, what we found was a bit of a different Congress, and that we haven't let off one bit on the question of the need for them to implement the Economic Recovery Act of LaRouche's. But the approach that the LaRouche youth movement is taking now, because what we've seen is it's obvious that there's an increasing amount of discussion going on behind closed doors in labor circles and in Congress on the need to implement LaRouche's program, that we're even seeing in our work in Congress, the youth movement is seeing an increasing number of freakouts coming from the congressional staff, because the pressure is on now with the housing bubble collapse, and also now with the increasing number of layoffs coming in the auto sector. Is that the angle that we're taking with the congressional work now is that LaRouche has been right. He said that the issue is FDR and ending the Truman era, and that the Democratic Party has got to get on board, that LaRouche has been the real Democratic Party, that the LaRouche youth movement is increasingly becoming an institution for a scientific renaissance, and that any sane part of the Democratic Party is going to join with us in pushing this agenda, and that's what's on the table, just sort of confidently going in and bringing them into our sphere of sane discussion about changing this thing.
Hold on for just a program announcement, which we have to make at this time for only half a minute, and then we'll continue with everyone. We just are repeating that this is the LaRouche Show, which is weekly from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, out of the United States. This is September 23rd, 2006, and you know on our website we are www.larouchepub.com, LaRouchePub.com. And I recommend very much that at any time to get information on what Bill Roberts and others are referring to as Economic Recovery Act of 2006 or the related matter of let's sweep clean and cage up the Bush-Cheney regime. Let's have them impeached. Here is a toll-free number you can use to get in touch with the LaRouche Youth Movement or the LaRouche Political Action Committee. You dial 1-800-929-7566. That's 1-800-929-7566. And those of you listening by telephone message line later in the week, I know you're not listening live, do use that number if in any way to, you know, to stay in special touch, those of you not on the user getting with us by internet. And once more, I'll say it maybe before the show closes again. Right now, put down Halloween, October 31st, for a true Halloween positive, joyful surprise. There will be an international webcast simultaneous in Berlin and Washington, D.C. by LaRouche and others in dialogue with him.
Scare the hell out of the Democrats.
Yeah, this is to scare people to be good. And the title of this is The World Crisis on the Eve of the U.S. Midterm General Election. And that'll be 10 a.m. in the United States Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in Berlin in Germany. And you will... you can see that. You can find information on LaRouchePub.com or look at LaRouchePAC.com. So again, I welcome our guests in New York, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And so after Bill's update on the uplifting, ass-kicking experience to Congress. I had interrupted Dan, but I'll ask anyone to go ahead and jump in on this or related. Go ahead.
I would just like to make a comment. This is Dan. One of the things I think the public is missing about the deindustrialization of our country is it is a national security issue, and those that are amputating it really are traitors and need to be dealt with, because we have to make things in this country, and we have to be able to defend ourselves and provide for our defense, and we're going to be extremely vulnerable if they complete this, if not worse off.
I agree 100%. I believe the industrial base was the backbone of our nation, and if you look at almost every other rising up-and-coming nation, that's what's doing it for them, and it just doesn't seem to make any sense to dismantle completely our industrial base. If you don't produce anything, your economy, to me, seems that it's based on paper and plastic, and it can only go so far before it caves in on itself.
Let me put a two-part question here to you all in this sense. We have a situation where Paul Gallagher and other people here have referred to the fact that we've passed a certain phase. You can see the crash process. More people can see the crash process. Let me put it that way. And in fact, I refer to one email you all have got from Texas. It's from Teresa, who says, you look around and a lot of people pretend they don't see a failed economy. She's in a certain part of Texas. There seemed to be endless construction of new homes and businesses, not too many for sale signs yet on the homes. And there still seem to be a lot of newly purchased SUVs and things in those strip malls. But she said, how can this keep appearing like business as usual in this crashed economy? Well, for some people, it's not appearing that way, yet you still get some of the same business as usual appearing to address it. Paul Gallagher knows about the manufacturing caucus or the auto caucus in Congress, who will say something about that we have a problem, but not do anything effective. It's like with the farmers. You have agriculture. Dan, you'll know this in Wisconsin. Farmers for a couple decades have been underpaid for what they're producing, and yet Congress won't face that. They'll talk about some drought relief, which is certainly needed, and that's a good thing, but totally limited. I'm asking all of you about how much you see that this could swiftly change, that more people are being hit both by reality and by the LaRouche Youth Movement and by yourselves on the plant floor. I'm asking, how do you see it, Paul?
Well, we have to change it. I had looked at the question from Teresa in Texas earlier when I was referring to the situation in Loudoun County in order to just give an example. People keep up appearances, but their debt keeps getting greater and greater and greater until now, as the study on Loudoun County found, it's the people with the relatively new SUVs driving into the bread line to ask for food aid twice a month, wearing business suits, because household debt has reached a point where these bubbles have to collapse. They were all originally based on the value of real estate, and the U.S. and United Kingdom real estate bubbles, together with this kind of last gasp, the commodity bubble of the last few years, those are now going down, and there's nothing left there but the debt that's sitting on top of those people who have appeared to have a certain standard of living, and it's gone. It's now gone. Now, the crucial thing is what Dan just brought up a minute ago. The people who have deindustrialized the country are traitors. You can't do anything about this without finding out who they are, who the most important of them are, getting out an expose, getting Felix Rowatton's name and crimes and rubbing it in the face of every congressman, as the LaRouche Youth Movement was doing both on the Hill and also in the recess, the way Bill was describing. You've got to do that. John Train, this issue of EIR will add the name and the crimes and the face of John Train and the banking network that he's a part of and has been for decades to these wreckers, these traitors. The only way to overturn this is to call out to the public at large, we've found the traitors, who they, here they are, here's what they're doing, help us bring them down. That is an entirely different approach than asking for aid for a troubled industry or something of that sort. So that's what has begun to dent, that approach is what has begun to dent the Congress to where we now hear some of them sort of shouting at us, no, 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 not until after the election. Mm-hmm. Whereas a month ago or 2 months ago, they were saying, no, no, not me, not me, I won't do it. Now it's changed to, no, I won't do it till after the election. So we know that, and as he said, we are driving these people still to put this Economic Reconstruction Act of LaRouche in. We've given them, we've written it all out. We've written it as legislation. We've given it to them. We've done that work for them.
So, do you see that? Do we still have Michael in Saginaw? That gives a perspective to things, because you're right in the heart of it there, aren't you, in Michigan?
I mean, I believe wholeheartedly what I've been hearing so far. It seems like Bush and the boys are doing more economic terrorism than any terrorist I ever experienced in my life. I mean, they're worried about the other terrorists, but yet they're making money off of the so-called terrorist situation that they're having by flying all these airplanes over there. And who's getting paid for that? What industry is getting paid for every bomb that they drop? Who's getting paid to fuel those airplanes up to keep on coming back and forth? I think anybody doing that but Bush and Cheney and his friends. You know, it just, you know, really shameful that they would do this to America just to keep, you know, to try to build up some families where they want their family's name to be in the history books forever, as far as financially or politically and stuff like that is concerned. I mean, people in the Midwest are really hurting right now. I mean, we're supposed to be one of the biggest auto industry in the country. And now we're getting layoffs, and people, the family's been disrupted, and people are going from one city to another, chasing General Motors, and it's just really shameful what's happening in Saginaw right now.
Who says we haven't been attacked for 5 years?
Yeah, right.
Well, I know that. Look, the important thing in this is that we've got to name the names, just like Paul said, in terms of who has been behind this. It's. You know, two names in particular, and a third of John Train that we're going to be getting into more in this next issue of EIR. But the two names that we've been pointing to specifically over and over again are Felix Rohatyn, who is part of the DLC, who has been specifically behind this the operations to bankrupt and destroy the various industries, the key industries of the country. And also George Shultz, who, interestingly enough, you know, when you talk about the destruction, talk about, you know, Katrina, you talk about the destruction of the United States industrial base and these horrors. This is, you know, we don't just speak of George Bush and Cheney. We speak of George Shultz, who was the architect of the Bush administration. And interestingly enough, right now, our youth movement on the West Coast, in discussions between those among our youth movement who are actually elected officials in the L.A. County Central Committee, are hammering at the question that the Democratic Party in California, in order to effectively combat Schwarzenegger, has to point out the fact that there can't just be a they have to stop being impotent, and they must name the name of the fascist who is behind Arnold Schwarzenegger, who has been behind Schwarzenegger since day one, who is George Shultz. And if you do that, then people will actually understand what is actually the difference between voting for a Democrat and voting for someone like Schwarzenegger, because Schwarzenegger himself has done much to try to blur the lines between the Democrats and himself. Even though his policies have been fascist, he's now begun speaking about the need for infrastructure, right? and a number of things that sound almost like something LaRouche would say. But it's a but the point that this is a campaign to destroy the nation state is the key question that any discussion, any politically potent discussion, has to start from. And in addressing that question from the standpoint of how Franklin Roosevelt did this, how Franklin Roosevelt defended the nation state, and who his enemies were, who was trying to assassinate Roosevelt at the time, who was behind that. This was the Bush family networks of the time. So this is the George Shultz networks, this is the Felix Rohatyn Synarchy networks, and that has to be brought out.
Yeah, among the operations that to confuse people, in other words, don't name any names, don't identify who is literally doing evil. The way that Schwarzenegger and Al Gore get together and others is they go for these things that Dan will recognize in Wisconsin, public-private partnerships, PPPs, that are supposed to induce you to do things like sell off your museum or your water system or the Chicago Skyway. And I think Milwaukee sold its museum, Dan. And you're supposed to sell off your assets, your hospitals, your life, and to these syndicates of bankers. So much for that. I'm just saying that in passing. But I just want to throw out one question that's come again from a different emailer in Texas, Richard, who is pointing out the ripple effects of when you start shutdown in one area. He's pointing out about industry at large causing ripple effects of destruction, like in small businesses, subcontractors. Once the regular factory can shut down, then all of the secondary area is affected. And I know people are all familiar with that. Andy, you especially have been pointing that out in Western New York. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's very big here because, we've got Tonawanda Powertrain, which produces engines for General Motors. Lockport has the Delphi Thermal Plant, which produces air conditioning and heating units. You've got Saginaw Gear and Axle in Buffalo, which makes rear axle assemblies, and then you've got a forge that produces engine blocks and raw forgings for the axles. And each one of those plants is fed primarily by local businesses. There's a place called Curtis Screw and Bolts, something to that effect. They supply massive amounts of nuts and bolts for the auto industry. There are plastics companies, even small mom-and-pop machine shops that they just take on small prototype type of work, that type of thing. But you see the ripple effect, the trucking industry, the people that drive, and everything that goes with that. Wherever you have people going to work, you have people buying coffee and donuts and breakfast and stopping on the way home to have clothes cleaned. Every industrial place, whether it's blue-collar or not, has a white-collar workforce as well, whether it be 2 or 200. But you have dry cleaners, you have just the whole gauntlet of things, people stopping for coffee and donuts, you name it. Every little business, the mom-and-pop shops, Lockport in particular, houses are going up for sale at a reduced rate. Coffee shops have shut down. All of those little businesses, on top of being Walmarted out of business, now there's just no money to support them.
Absolutely. We find the same thing here in Wisconsin. And I guess that's one thing I'd like to let those that are listening and their friends know, that this will affect every person in this country, whether they have a MBA because there's no more factories left, or if it's a financial advisor, there won't be the 401k income to provide their job. The service economy has really set up a complete failure when manufacturing goes under.
Right.
And in terms of the details of what Richard from Texas has said in the email, it is 60,000 jobs that have been lost in the auto supply sector since the beginning of 2005. So that's less than 2 years. And then you just add the ones that have left GM in the same period of time, you're already at 100,000 in the auto sector jobs that have been lost. And most of them are in supply rather than in the big automakers' assembly plants. And then, as Andy was describing, you've got jobs and jobs and jobs around them. The auto sector is shrinking at something like 10% a year at this point. And for 100 years, it's been the center gear of the United States economy. So any leadership that would let this happen without taking action to reverse it is just a pack of fools, or else they're criminal bandits like we've got in the White House now.
I think you're right on both.
And fools that are tolerating them. They need to take this capacity. You can't keep selling more and more cars to people whose homes, the value of whose homes, are collapsing around them, because that's what they were using to buy the cars. So they need to take this capacity and use it to build railroads, to build infrastructure, for that matter, to re-equip the National Guard and Army units, who are non-deployable now. As the generals admit, we don't have a single non-deployed unit in the National Guard or the Army which is deployable, because their equipment has all been wrecked in the course of the rotations in and out of Iraq, and the Pentagon is not getting it replaced. So there's a job for the machine tool capability of the auto sector. They're the most crucial economic logistic tasks facing the economy. That's what LaRouche would do.
Even the as the economy crashes, construction down in Madison, it had been booming for quite some time. It has now hit the bricks, and carpenters, union carpenters, non-union carpenters, contractors are going into bankruptcy, and the unemployment in the trades is rapidly picking up.
Let me turn one, just stick one thing in here, because we have, it's amazing, we only have 9 minutes left, but Bill Roberts, I point out, you were, in a matter of construction, there's so many, people have mentioned nuclear power, we have collapsing, look at our rail systems, look at water systems, but on the dams of the Ohio River, right there in the auto states, you were involved in public meetings where it was brought out what could be done. What would people change their minds, or how would they see it? For example, you were at Ohio towns in these meetings.
Yeah,
the Army Corps of Engineers had
meetings. Corps of Engineer. They held hearings in a number of towns in the various districts along the Ohio River, and they wanted to get testimony from the people who lived in that area and whose industries and work were affected by the many shutdowns that had occurred in the lock systems along the river. And you had it was very good. In a number of these meetings, you just had a large turnout of people who understood very precisely what the link was between this public infrastructure and their own livelihood. In certain instances, you had people speaking who actually understood the history of this area as an economic region, as a product of this infrastructure having been built going back 50, 80 years. And it was just very clear because, the Army Corps of Engineers, they say they can't get political. They can only sort of give an objective picture and let the people in Washington, D.C. do the political things. So they were very happy to get this testimony and to also hear what LaRouche was proposing in terms of this Economic Recovery Act and this plan, to use the auto sector, the idle capacity to build these projects, not only, but also to use these projects as a means by which you could employ tens of thousands, minimally, of youth who are currently have no future, who have not ever had any sort of real gainful employment, to be brought into these programs and employed usefully, and to take something back to their community. So there was a extremely good dialogue at these meetings, and you could really see that there's a, you know, if this was something that the Congress, the Democrats would act on, they would have a tremendous amount of support. And I don't, it's hard to, you know, it seems pretty crazy that they wouldn't go ahead with these things, that they're either misinformed or just very afraid of doing that at this point. But
some of what you said that just prompted a thought with me that you talked about jobs for youth, and I often think about all of the young people that are over fighting all of these wars everywhere.
Yeah.
And if and when they are brought home, what careers and what futures do they have? And it just boggles mm-hmm. my mind to think that you could go and fight and come home and find nothing for you, and we may be creating a generation of people that are dependent on military careers, and who knows, it may be part of someone's plan that the next generation leans on the military to support them because there is nothing else.
Up in your area, Andy, there is a Democratic candidate named Eric Massa, not right in your area, but in upstate New York, who is campaigning for a Republican incumbent seat in Congress and is demanding legislation to create CCC-type camps to build infrastructure. We're very close to seeing legislation on a small scale introduced into the Congress as a result of our mobilization, which does this, which is addresses itself to the jobs side of this, and particularly for youth and for unemployed people. But it's candidates like him that are winning in the primaries that have been occurring lately. In many cases, they are beating the candidates that have the financial and other backing of the Democratic Party officially, because they're calling for bold steps. They're calling for getting out of Iraq, impeaching Bush and Cheney, and other bold steps like that. They're calling for an FDR approach to the economy. In fact, even on the UAW Solidarity site, there's a get out and vote message from the president.
Why don't you read that, Paul?
From President Gettelfinger, which compares the current election, although it isn't really strong on what to do in Congress, but it compares the current election to that of 1932, when people voted against Herbert Hoover more than they voted for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he says. A time of hopelessness and homelessness, when voters were fed up with Hoover's indifference to the poor and the unemployed and his failure to create jobs. Very important that he points to the FDR period and FDR's election in terms of the kind of change that's possible here. But it's not the leadership of the Democratic Party that's going for this change right now. It's insurgents running against leadership-backed candidates. And the good thing is that in the primaries recently, the insurgents, not just Joe Lieberman, but other party-backed candidates, one might say do-nothing candidates, are being beaten by these insurgents. So that's
It speaks to their honesty. They're willing to put themselves and their identity on the line for what they believe in, as opposed to whatever, what the dollars will pay for, what the lobbyists influence them. They're stepping up and saying what they believe to be right, regardless of the political outcome of it, and I think people are buying into it. People see that this is a real candidate. It's not just somebody that's towing the line because he's being paid to do this or that. And I think it's time. People are ready for change.
And it's in times like these that people can get over their cynicism and realize that history is, in fact, shaped by ideas and not by any of the things that they thought it was shaped by, like money.
Ideas and people willing to take a chance.
Right. And in fact, we have very few seconds left. But in other words, instead of chain reactions of shutdown, if we have any kind of leadership, we could have some chain reactions of buildup. Andy, you looked at that, didn't you, up in the kinds of conversion you could have of still remaining capacity in your big complex you described?
Oh, absolutely. Millions of square feet, not only at our location, but all of these other plants. They just announced Friday that American Axle in Buffalo will be closing in 2008.
And how big a space is that for potential production?
Oh, I want to say, I'm going to guess 1 million square feet of floor space. And they've got rail lines tied into it. Trucking roads were put in specifically for the use of that plant. State money was garnered to put in specific roads for to allow trucking access within the last 10 years, which is another thing that I just find it criminal that these companies soak up all of this state and federal money on the pretext of help us, you know, give us the money and we'll stay in your town. They take that money, the roads are put in, and oh, sorry, we can't make it. Well, where did the $10 million go that we gave you?
Well, I think you've had the last word, and there's no. It's always good to denounce corruption along with cowardice and evil. And
the
I'll
Halliburton
tell you,
effect.
The Halliburton effect. And I want to thank you all because you mentioned that this axle and gear plant wouldn't be shut till 2008. Well, we have time in the next few days, weeks, and months that we want to put a stop to all of that and turn things around. And that's why I thank you all for today, Andy and Michael, Dan, Paul, and Bill, and I ask everyone to stay tuned again September 30th on Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. 2006 on LaRouchePub.com, and especially get the dirt and the lowdown on this lowdown character, John Train. This is Marcia Mary Baker. Thank you for the LaRouche Show.
Thank you all.